Who knows, I might want to walk around a little bit. My name is Merlin, I'm an alcoholic. I'm very glad to be here, very grateful. I think we're very fortunate. I see my boy Steven Sheehan over there. we have been through a lot. I wouldn't normally tell this story, but one time I had just, on my birthday, I had been, you remember this story very well. I was asleep on my bed, like butt naked. My girlfriend had just left, and I heard at the door, "Police, open up!" And I was like, "Dang!" And I said, "Well, I'm just gonna stay just like this then." So then they came in and they circled around me, and they're like, you know, they're real mean. And I was butt naked, and he knocked on the door, and they jerked him inside and sat him down. And then the cops, they said, come out here in the hallway. Everybody sit in the living room. And I was like, I had a towel. They gave me a towel, so I wrapped it around my waist, and I walked out there, and the cops were like, "Put your freaking hands up." I was like, "But I'm naked." They said, "I don't care." So I said, and they all started making fun of me. And they were like, and John was like, they said they were looking for drugs. They found a joint on my TV. I was arguing, like, what am I going to jail for? And the cop, he said, "Marijuana!" I started laughing at him. And I was like, "Really?" They made me do 45 days for that joint, though. Anyways, just thought I'd throw that out there since my boy is here. I don't really think too much. I should have probably put some thought into this, but I'm okay with just kind of freestyling. I was born and raised in South Austin. With my mom and my dad and my older brother. I called my dad because he raised me since I was a baby, my stepdad. I grew up behind that Gardner Betts Juvenile Detention Center on Congress. Some of y'all are probably familiar. I was pretty a juvenile delinquent. I used to like pour gas on cars and catch them on fire. And I broke into my school when I was in elementary a couple times and burned down a portable and stole all the musical instruments. That was like the kind of stuff I did for fun. I remember running through the juvie when they were remodeling it and looking at those metal toilets, like with my skateboard trying to break stuff. And it was cool because I already knew the floor plan. Like, when I started going back, I was like, "I think I know where the child hall is over there." by the time when I was 15, I drank every day and smoked weed every day. I loved cocaine, and there wasn't probably a person in this world that could have told me I was doing anything wrong. I just did it because it was fun. You know, my mom, when I was 15, joined Al-Anon, and she kicked me out. She couldn't handle me too much. She kicked me and my dad out. My dad was I used to not like Al-Anon, but, you know, I think it's important to remember that's one group of people that's there entirely because they love us. So I don't diss Al-Anon. I'm a big fan. But at the time, I was like, "They told you to kick me out. It's their fault." But so my dad, he joined AA and got sober. I wasn't feeling it, so I just went to party more. But AA forever changed my dad. Like, I remember growing up, and I had this golden retriever we got when I was 5 years old. And had it my whole life, and we'd come home after being out all day, and the dog would like trap on the floor because we had left it in. And my dad would go into, he was an alcoholic, but he shot at meth mostly. And he would go into like those meth rages and get his belt and turn like bright red, like real angry people do, and beat the dog. Same belt he'd whoop our ass with, but like it hurts so much more watching him whoop the dog that I love. So I'd be like, "Man, why is he doing that?" And he'd take it outside and whoop it hard. And it kind of freaked me out. But there was times, throughout my life that, you know, after that, that I would call my dad on the phone crying and sad and, like, hopelessly depressed, like, when I was losing my house or getting a divorce and things like that. And, you know, my dad would say, he was a good AA. He didn't push AA on me, but he would say, man, Merlin, I know it feels like the end of the world, but it's not, you know, and I love you. And that's all he would say. And I remember, too, going back over there when I was, like, 20, and he had a new dog. And we came in one time, and that dog had crapped on the floor. And I was like, oh, shit. Like, I knew it was fixing to happen, but, you know, he was like, hey, little, are you okay? Oh, did we keep you inside all day? Oh, we started cleaning up. I was like, man, he's a different person. And I trusted him more than anything, despite some messed up shit he did when I was younger. And I just say that because long before I was ready to get into this cult called Alcoholics Anonymous, I saw how it changed other people's lives, and I'm very grateful my dad got sober. And if my 12-year-old, my 13-year-old, or my 4-year-old daughter had any idea what 12-step program has done for me, they'd be very grateful for it also. Anyways, I got a little off track with that one. I think, you know, like I said, I got high and drank for fun, but when I really, really discovered the true power of alcohol, I was 16, and my dad came and got me out of school and told me that my brother had died. He was 19, he was a few years older than me, from alcohol poison, and I was crushed. You know, he was the person at the time I loved the most in my family, and so I got drunk. And then I blacked out, and the next day I just knew that I had forgot everything from the night before when I started drinking. And the alcohol, I found the power to forget. And that's really just all I wanted, was to forget. So I spent like the next year just forgetting everything from the day before, pretty much every day. And that caused some problems. Like, by the time I was 17, you know, I was an adult in Texas, and I got, you know, some DWIs and several felonies and several misdemeanors. Not for anything like glorious. Like, I drove my car up some stairs and into somebody's house with a couple pounds of weed, and, you know, like an idiot. But I was pretty like a loose cannon. I didn't know what I was doing. And they actually charged me with tax evasion for not paying taxes on the weed, which I was pretty upset about. and then after that, you know, I kept bonding out. I didn't think about, like, this is stuff will come back. I just paid them their money and got out. And I was like, shit, no big deal. Do what I want. I just pay and get out. That only lasts so long. Like, my friend dared me. He said, I dare you to steal that bicycle. I got a robbery case for it. I didn't have a shirt on. I just tattooed my name. And my name's Merlin. So I dare you to steal that bicycle. I was like, oh, you don't dare me? And I jumped out of the car and I stole his bicycle. And they were like, Merlin, Merlin! So I got a robbery case for that. And eventually they were like, well, you can't bond out anymore. So, yeah, they locked me up for like a year or so, and I got out and got drunk, and they locked me right back up. They actually sent me here that time. It was a little bit different. I don't think this room was here, and it was called REAP, but it was cool. It's a good program. I dug it back then, and I got out and went to this place called the Stratford House for 11 months. Remember that spot? And then they moved us to McCabe while I was there, like halfway through. I had been to some meetings and been to some rehabs. You know, they had sent me through that SMART program and stuff. that's kind of a different kind of rehab though than this. And so I got introduced to AA really about that time. I was 19 years old, and I came in and, like, obviously I had a drinking problem, a drug problem. And I say I'm an alcoholic. You know, I shot heroin for 10 years. That's really probably what I love the most. But and I shot meth for 10 years also every day. And I did a lot of cocaine and smoked crack. You know how progression. I said I'd never use a weapon, and I shot up for 10 years. I did a lot of things that I said I would never do. But I came into today and I hung out because I was in that Stratford house for about a year, and I listened to what people were saying, and I just, like, I thought I was smarter. You know, I'd be like, man, that dude, he already went to prison twice. It's stupid. I wouldn't do that. You got 5 DWIs? Like, what's wrong with these people? I thought I was smarter. Some people I thought I was better than them. Some people I thought I wasn't as cool as them. Really, I just did a lot of comparing. Thought I was really just kind of different than other people. And all that comparing kind of kept me separated. So when, like, I started hearing people say, like, accept spiritual help or go on to the bitter end and die alcoholic death and all that, I was like, fuck this, I'm going to look for door number 3. And I kind of burned off. Those didn't sound like good ideas. And so like I said, alcoholism is progressive. So I started adding more and more substances, drinking more and more, and doing all of it a whole lot more often. And with that, like, also progressive was the amount of times I would get locked up and how long they would keep me, and a lot of times how far away they would send me. I remember, like, I got busted with my son. I got a 3-year-old son. He was 3, and I left. And I swore when I was locked up, you know, I'm not going to, I'm done with this. I'm not going to do all this again, leave my family behind, not take care of them. And I got out, and I met Jen. Me and my son's mom got a divorce. I met Jen, and we had a beautiful baby. And when that baby was 8 months old, you know, I went back again. And I thought, damn, I swore I wouldn't do this. And I did the same thing I did the time before. I wrote everybody letters, like my mom. Mom, I'm done. I'm sure I told Jen that as well. And everybody believed me, though, because I was telling the truth. I just couldn't uphold my own promise for some reason. You know, my mom came and picked me up in Huntsville and drove me back to Austin. We had Schlotzky. It was good. You know how that first one out of prison? And we pulled up at the same house behind Garden of Beth, the same house I grew up in. It's quite comforting. It was the end of a perfect day. Not a cloud in the horizon. And I stepped out of the car, and my neighbor at my mom's house said, "Hey, Merlin, where you been? I ain't seen you in a long time. You clean? You want to get high?" I said, "Well, yeah." And it was that quick. Despite everything I said, I had absolutely no mental defense against the first drink or shot of meth in this instance. You know, that's something that got progressively shorter, I guess, would be the amount of time I could stay clean after I would get stopped from whatever it was that stopped me that time. You know, also progressive, alcoholism progressive in a lot of ways. Something else progresses is like the amount of hurting other people I did, especially like the amount I hurt the people that I love the most, leaving my kids behind. There's one time, and it's not even the only time this happened, but I couldn't go home because either Jen's mom was there, and I didn't get along with the mother-in-law, or Jen had kicked me out because I used to come home, and then I would stay in the car, and I would pass out, and she would come out there, and I would have the radio in my hand. She'd be like, "You fucking asshole," and then she would tell me, "Get out of here." But you know how them dope smokers are? "That's all you second shit shoot dope. Get out of here." And she kicked me out, but for whatever reason I couldn't go home, so I went to my mom's house, and I was getting high back there, and I fell out. And I banged my head on one of these little dresser things, you know, and my mom came in there in the morning. That, I wasn't OD, I wouldn't say. It was just regular daily behavior for me. And but my mom was like, the next day, she was like, "Mom, you know how it feels? Like, I already have one son die." My mom's a nurse. She's like, "I gotta take your pulse, check your breathing, sit here and watch you with your lips looking all blue, and make sure you're not dead." And that sucks. Like, you know, I can't know how that feels. I know I got kids. To me, it's pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization, you know, over and over, over and over again. The kind of shit we go through. I know what it's like to sit and look at Joe all night and be tapping him on the face like, "Dude, you look too blue, we're good." So I know what that feels like. I can't imagine it being my kid, but yeah, it's a bummer. So what happened, like, what's progressive also is the level of pain, the hurting that I would feel. Like, you know, Joey put it to me good. One day he called me like 5 years ago, and he used this little analogy. I don't know if he remembers. He would call me and he said, "Bro, it's like you ever seen the Sylvester the cat when he's floating on that raft and the water pops up and he's like, 'Oh, damn.' Boop." And then the water pops up another hole, and he's like, "Boop." And then another hole, and "Boop." And then more water comes through, and then after a while, you run out of fingers and toes, and the water keeps coming and just drowning. He's like, "That's how I feel like, man, every day, with bills, with problems." And I get that, because in the end of my getting high, that's how it was. I felt like I was drowning. Every day from the time I woke up to the time I went to bed, the pain was so bad and I hurt so much. And when there's no possible way it could hurt worse, I could feel like any less of a person, I still hurt worse the next day. You know, I was really good at lowering expectations. Like, my son would miss like 30 days of school, and I would say, "Well, I mean, the school system sucks anyways, and at least he's passing." But then when I couldn't get him to school at all, and like I kind of had to just pass him off to his grandparents, like, "Fuck, I can't do this. I can't function enough to take care of a kid." You know, I couldn't be okay with that. And so, like, my life for a long time really escalated so fast downhill that I couldn't adjust being mentally okay with what was going on. I could handle not being successful or having a shitty job, but, you know, when everything just starts hitting you at once. And so I was in a lot of pain, and I still couldn't stop getting high. And I still fought it, though, you know, like, as screwed as I was, I would go see my parole officer, and he was like, "Dude, I don't think you're all right." I was like, "No, dude, I'm fucked." He would say, are you gonna pass a drug test?" I was like, "No way." And then I would see him, and he's like, "What are you gonna do?" "I'm gonna go to rehab." You know how we do, right? Be like, for like 6 months, "I told you, man, I'm going to rehab." And I went in the next month, and he was like, "Dude, you're nothing worse." My parole officer would take my keys from me. and maybe get somebody to come up there and get me. He's like, dude, what are you doing? I told you, bro, I'm going to rehab. Eventually, he was like, well, I think you're going to die, dude, so I'm going to put the warrants out. So when you come back in 2 weeks, I'm going to lock you up. Unless you get into rehab, that's when I, you know, they got somebody that's good to have. I like that little fire, because it's as desperate and horrible off as I was, I was still like, I'll just ride this shit out for a little longer and see if I make something work. And but that day, my PO told me, that was a Thursday, I went home, I called the rehab, I already had talked to him on the phone, and they got funded, they're also, I was like, hey, I gotta hurry. And, you know, I told everybody I was waiting, they were like, well, you wanna come in tomorrow? I was like, shit, hold on. That's too quick. They said, how about Monday? I said, how about Tuesday? Yeah, we're fucking crazy, right? Some of y'all did that shit coming in here, I guarantee it. Y'all can relate. Like, I get off the phone with the rehab, they're like, yeah, you can come in 3 days. I'm like, but can I come in about 3 weeks? Yeah, you can do that too. I got the phone.
Hey, mom, they said I could come in 3 weeks.
Okay, bro. Yeah, like, see if I can do this a little while longer. Maybe it'll get better. It's only been like 25 years. But so I went to that Centacor and... I went to that Centacor in Waco, 30-day program. My lovely mom drove me up there. He's like, no, Centacor is not lovely. It doesn't really matter where you go, you know. When you're done and ready to accept some help, there's a lot of places that offer it. And it's as flawed as sometimes I think the rehabs are, I mean, we're very, very fortunate to have Austin Recovery. I love this place. I mean, they do a lot for us. They might make mistakes, but we're not really easy people to deal with. You know what I mean? We put these people out. Yeah. I can only imagine the, like, counselor meetings. Like, these douchebags. That's what I'd be saying. I'd be like, but, you know, so try to, it's our job to take the high road in these situations, you know, we're bringing stuff on ourselves. But, yeah, my mom drove me up there, you know, and I had to get high a few times on the way there, you know, I gave my mom hell, like, running in every truck stop to try to hit my foot, you know, and the thing, and when I got to rehab, I looked at things different. I was like, man, I'm going to do whatever I got to do. I've been like maybe 7 rehabs. I think this is the 7th one, maybe the 8th. And I started reading the book. I started reading the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I didn't do like I had done the first time that I read that book. I made a lot of comparison. When I read the book this time, it was... You know, those first 50 pages or so, it was as if they wrote the book just for me. Like, I identified with all that stuff. You know, I don't know when I crossed this fine line into alcoholism, this invisible line. I don't know if I was born with alcoholism. I don't know if I induced it by drinking a lot. I really don't care. You know, the fact is that I'm definitely an alcoholic. Solution's the same. But, you know, so when I got out of the rehab, you know, I listened, paid attention. I got out of rehab and I started going to meetings. You know, I was diehard about it. I drove in and went to a 5:30 meeting at Bolden and then an 8 o'clock meeting. I was like, I'm scared. I better go to another one. I went to the 10:30 Westlake. I went a lot every day. And I listened to what people were saying and I identified with what people were saying then too, and that identifying started to get me connected. You know, doing a lot of comparing kept me separated, but I was no longer comparing myself to others. I had gotten very humble. So I started doing some things. You know, I still like, I like to think that I'm smart and shit, you know. And I still thought I had some pretty good ideas, but I kind of believed what they say in here, you know, alcoholism centers in the mind, right? So I really don't got a whole lot of business doing a lot of stuff that I think is a good idea, especially, you know, the day after I walked out of rehab, you know. And so I got a sponsor and started doing this step work. And sometimes it was small things. Like my sponsor will say, somebody would get a 30-day chip or a 60-day chip. My sponsor would say, go over there and talk to that dude. Shake his hand. I would think, what the fuck, man? I don't want to talk to that dude, but I would just say, like, okay, and I go talk to him. Hey, Mr. Guy, congratulations. I started talking to people, and that started getting me connected. And then, you know, I was sober like 2 months, still fresh out of rehab, so I think I was gone like 40 days. Detox took a little while. And my sponsor said, well, you come to this little rehab and tell your story. And I thought, hell no. But I was like, oh, okay, because I'm just going to do what other people say is a good idea. Remember, disease centers in the mind. So I did that, and that got me kind of out of myself. I started thinking about, can I say something to help somebody else? Is there something good I can do? And that got me connected on that level. My sponsor would say stuff like, he's pretty mellow. He's going to push me and make me call him every day. But, like, some things he says I really hear. And I remember I was riding in the car with him. And he said, well, yeah, Murray, people with service commitments tend to have a better chance of staying sober. I'm like, oh, really? So, and I definitely believe that to be true. You know, I didn't know when I got sober that service, being of service to others was going to be such a big part of it. But, you know, the book does say what the our very lives depend on the constant thought of others and how we can help meet their needs. They say it's a selfish program. I just have a real hard time finding how it's selfish. I guess it does say when you're working with a newcomer, if they don't want to do the work, move on to the next one that does, for they have already helped you much more than you could ever help them. So I guess in that sense, maybe it's a little selfish. I go back and forth on that one. I really think that, you know, selfishness, self-centeredness is the root of my problem. And it seems like, to me, this whole program of AA is about getting rid of some of that selfishness and self-centeredness and learning to be of service to others and do what we can do to help. I took to AA real hardcore this time. I had always believed that it would work, you know, because I seen the effect that it had on my dad. It's just like I would sit in those meetings sometimes and think, like, in the past, like, man, this sugar seemed to be doing a lot of good for a lot of people, man. Like, I wish I was like them. I wish it would work for me. And that kept me out of the rooms for a long time. But understanding the 12 steps and going through this work has made a huge difference in my life. You know, I talked about that coming into AA and thinking that I'm different. And being separated, what going through this work, and I looked at it. This is more of the stuff I did that I looked at and thought, that's not really, like, what does that have to do with drinking? Like, probably nobody looked at it and thought, oh yeah, that's what I need to do. Like, we don't come in here and think that I do it. The steps, the actions don't care why you take them, is what my sponsor said. You know, take it, believe in God, don't believe in God, just take these actions. And I started doing that. For me, the hardest step to take was admitting that I was powerless over alcohol, admitting that I was completely defeated by this whole thing. And that was humbling, and that made the rest of the steps easy. The fourth step really wasn't a hard thing to me. The God thing is a little bit weird, but the way I see it, the more and more I do this work and the more and more I tap into this power, and I definitely believe as a result of going through this work, I've tapped into a source of power far greater than myself. But the more and more I do this work and the more and more I tap into that power, the less and less I actually care what that power might be. And some people maybe care more. You know, a lot of people have read a lot of books about it for a lot of years. And we're still not really in agreement as a whole as to he, she, it, what. And yeah, to me that doesn't matter. But the way life is different today, like I was broken for most of my life. And if you look at what goes on in my life today, it's really not all that special, you know. Well, I mean, it is super special, but it's not that out of the ordinary, you know. I have a wife, and we live together, and I take care of my four-year-old daughter. My son lives with me, you know. He makes straight A's in school, which is for no doing, not for my teaching. I was fortunate he turned out smart, you know, I got a bank account that hasn't been overdrawn, right? I got a job that I actually go to, and I'm not going to get fired and lose it or anything like that. We play a lot of games, and all that is fine, but that's just regular shit for regular people. But for me, it's something completely amazing. You know, like, alcoholics are here. Alcoholics be the only person that, like, super, super excited and thrilled just to be all right. You know what I mean? Like, yeah, dude, I make minimum wage and I got one bedroom. Yeah! Like, you know, and when I lay down at night, you know, I said this the other day, like, money can't buy a softer pillow than my old pillow has gotten, because sometimes I lay down and I'm just okay. You know, I'm cool with whatever's going on. And that's something for my whole entire life. I've never been, like, just okay with stuff. It's like, to be okay is an amazing feat, you know? And there's a lot of cool moments, like, the same mom that I put through hell, you know, she came to see me speaking at Primary Purpose Group a couple weeks ago, and she'll say, this makes me happy. I'm just let me have this moment. And that, like, my mom, when I was going to rehab before I went this last time, she was like, you suck. That's all you do is suck. We're going to stop sucking so bad. And that's what she would say. Stay away from my mouth. Praise Al-Anon, right? But, you know, that's what she needed, you know. I can't imagine my kids going through this. But and seeing Jen sober, like, when she taught my four-year-old the Serenity Prayer. And she can't quite say it right, but it's real cute. And sometimes, like, I didn't know she was doing all this, but I walked outside the other day. It's been a couple of months now, and I walked down to the back deck, and there she was, and my daughter, her head down, like, saying a prayer. And, like, I just, like, you know, money can't buy shit like that. Like, I was thrilled to see it, and I don't know if she saw me. I just went back in and kind of smiled, and I don't really say nothing, but these moments, like, it's really hard to explain or put words on the goosebumps that I get sometimes. You know, it's hard to put into words that tingle, that feeling that I get, that feels so right. and I'm just okay. I think the best, like, you know, if you have the opportunity to go through this work as outlined in our book and tap into this source of power that's far greater than you and live this life, then you'll have an opportunity to see what it is I'm talking about that I have a hard time putting into words, because it's a far different life than it ever was before. And as far as I still got like 5 minutes, right? Okay. I mean, I don't really got a whole lot left to say, but as far as staying sober, one of the biggest things for me is, you know, I come in here full of pride and fear. It's what kept me from doing this stuff for a long time, like, is my ego, you know. I look at four-step stuff, like, my ego shows up as pride, like, man, I don't need to do that shit. And then fear, like, even if I do make some list like that, I don't want to share it with anybody, you know, so... Guaranteed, if you're going to write a 4-step and your pride and fear is going to show up, but just walk through that stuff. The gifts are way worth it. Probably the best, I'm not going to say the best, the one thing I've learned through going through this over and over again, I'm doing the steps for the third time right now. Me and my sponsor meet every 2 weeks and go over it again. You know, I had to ask him. I was on fire for this thing. Like, I started getting the results. I wanted more. So after it had been a while, I was like, hey, dude, we should go through that shit again. You know, you hear guys like Chris say, well, I got to go through it again. I start getting, you know, I don't really know if I'm that guy because I stayed so involved, you know. I can't, I'm not that guy that's gotten into recovery and sobriety and had to fight a lot with, to struggle with wanting to get high a lot. You know, I got rid of the craving and the urge to get sober, and I don't know what part of this whole program is that does that for me, but I think a big part of it is I sponsor a lot of guys. I always keep a new one. Not to just say a new guy, but I always try to get a new guy and get them going through the work. And if they fall off, I go and get another new one. And some of them stay sober and a lot of them don't. My homeboy always says, I got a 100% track record with my sponsees. I'm like, you do? Damn. Yep, I stayed sober through every one of them. So I guess in a sense that... That's probably what we're talking about, a selfish program, huh? But the humility thing, you know, is I seem to have made this change to thinking that this whole life thing that I'm living here, I've spent this whole time trying to be successful or, you know, get things to suit me, my job, my girl. You were worried about what car I got or how I appear to others. But this whole life thing is really not, the 12 steps have seemed to teach me that this whole life thing is really not about me. You know, it's about other people and what I can do for somebody else, what I can say, any little thing. And somewhere along the line, I don't know where, when exactly I made that transition, but that's what's happened to me. I think, you know, we go through all kinds of prayer and meditation and trying to get in touch with God. And I think the best way for me to get closer to God, whatever that might be, is simply by trying to do something good for somebody else and be helpful in some way. Anyways, I think that I'm just rambling now. I mean, I could keep rambling for... So, I do a rehab during the week, and I do one every Saturday. Sometimes I'm too lazy to get speakers, but I got a lot of material. a lot of different stories. I try not to tell too many war stories, you know. My homeboy Joe's like, "Are you gonna tell about some of the fun shit we did?" I was like, "Not really, bro. Like, if I just wanted to sit and go over my criminal record, we would just sit and go over that for a while. Like, I'm on probation and parole right now. I got out of prison last time, and after I fell out of my mom's house, you know, I was like, well, I'm going to be a good son and shoot up in the car outside before I go in. So that better happen again, right? But then I fucking passed out in the car, and the cops woke me up, and I just had a gram of heroin and a gram of meth that last time. They arrested me. I stayed in the jail for like 5 days, and my parole officer came in there and said, "Are you going to bond up?" And I thought, "Well, are you going to send me back to prison?" And she said, "You know, thankfully they put this as a disease in the DSM. I mean, the Travis County is getting pretty nice." She said, I don't even stay with you." I said, "Really?" And I called my good buddy lawyer friend to come get me out. So they said when I went to court, you know how they always do, like, we'll drop one felony if you cop to the other. My lawyer said, "Which one you want, the heroin or the meth?" So I don't want anyone to think I'm a tweaker. Put me down with the heroin. So I'm on probation for heroin, not meth, and I'm parole. I'm still not perfect. My last probation appointment was 2 weeks ago, and my PO called me and said, "Where are you? It's not like I missed." I said, "Oh shit, did I miss?" "Yeah, we're home at 2 o'clock." I said, "All right." I was taking a nap, and I went back to sleep. The next day came and went. I forgot all about that shit. I had to call her last week. I was like, "Hey, I still had to come in there and get off probation." So I'll be off probation next week. I put it on my calendar this time. But, I could go on with stories like that forever, but I'm not going to do that. I appreciate you guys for being here and letting me do this. It's an honor. I love Austin and Kevin.